Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We've heard a lot about underwater homeowners over the last couple of years. Home values dropped off a cliff, and suddenly folks owed more on a mortgage than their house was worth. And then there are those who used their house as an ATM. What do you know? They're in trouble, too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday. It is the 7th day of June. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke said something today that we've been hearing for a while now. The economy will get better. High gas prices and the Japan earthquake put a crimp in the recovery, he told a banking conference in Atlanta, but growth should pick up in the second half of the year.
Overall, the economic recovery appears to be continuing at a moderate pace, albeit at a rate that is both uneven across sectors and frustratingly slow from the perspective of millions of unemployed and underemployed workers.
Bernanke gave no hint of any action the Fed might take to help out with that situation, but he did point to one sector of the economy that could do its part, you and me.
As is often the case, the ability and willingness of households to spend will be an important determinant of the pace at which the economy expands in coming quarters.
Well, the Fed itself said today that we are indeed spending money, but it is borrowed money, mostly for students and auto loans. We are still cutting back on credit card purchases. And another report today puts in stark terms the fallout from the bygone era of free spending and easy credit. CoreLogic, a housing data provider, found nearly 40% of homeowners who took out second mortgages now owe more than their home is worth. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more.
Susan Lagmay and her husband bought their home in Port Charlotte, Florida, 9 years ago for about $250,000. They borrowed almost the full amount, and as home prices rose, they refinanced and took out a second mortgage.
Over the next couple of years, we found banks that were willing to increase that line. And they were just taking our word for it as to what we felt the value was.
May and her husband actively used that line of credit.
Well, it started out paying off other debt. We did make improvements in our home, and we did buy an RV.
Now May is underwater. She owes about $350,000 on a home the county says is only worth $150,000. Today's report found people with second mortgages were twice as likely to be underwater as those with just one mortgage. And that puts them at increased risk of foreclosure, says Mike Fratatoni with the Mortgage Bankers Association.
The number of homeowners who are underwater, a lot of that is second mortgage debt. You know, it is going to be, you know, yet another hurdle for those borrowers to overcome.
And that spells big trouble for banks, says Harvard Business School's Nicholas Ritsinas. He says unlike mortgage loans, which banks bundled up and sold off, second mortgages are still on their balance sheets.
So the more we come to realize that second mortgages have no value, it's going to increase the capital requirements of banks and maybe put them in some jeopardy.
Ritsinas says that could mean banks tighten their purse strings at a time when business and other loans are needed to spur the economy. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The Italian fashion house Prada finds itself following a trend instead of leading one. Today, it became the latest Western company to seek a listing for its shares on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. Is floating an IPO in New York or London going out of style? Is Hong Kong the new black? Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London.
Prada aims to raise more than $3 billion, selling 20% of its shares. Brokers and bankers in London and New York who didn't get the business won't be happy. But, says Professor Joseph Lample of Cass Business School, floating in Hong Kong is a smart move for Prada. China is where most of its best customers are.
First of all, the economic situation there is much better, and the crisis has not hit the high earners, high net worth individuals in the Far East as much as it has in the West.
Prada is cashing in on the brand mania sweeping the ranks of China's nouveau riche. And that means not only selling them incredibly expensive handbags and shoes. Alpesh Patel of private equity group Profinium Partners says Prada is now offering its shares as a luxury item.
It's very much a Western brand, which adds to the cachet of being an owner either of the shares or of the product.
Prada's shares have a luxury price tag, selling at 27 times forecast earnings. Hardly surprising that other Western luxury goods makers are said to be considering a Hong Kong float. But there's still a crumb of comfort here for the West, says Alpesh Patel.
Europe and North America still owns the major brands, and they're still creating the major brands.
No consolation for Western bankers and brokers. More cash was raised on the Hong Kong stock market over the past 2 years than anywhere else on the planet. Prada's just the latest sign that floating shares in London or New York seems to be going out of fashion. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, a fifth day of losses. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Those mortgage figures we talked about earlier are just the most recent in a slew of economic numbers that we follow week in and week out. Some carry more weight than others, like last Friday's monthly jobs report and the GDP, gross domestic product. If you remember, the Commerce Department kept its original GDP estimate a couple of weeks ago, a weak 1.8% annual growth. But commentator Justin Wolfers warns that is not the entire story.
There's an untold story in the economic data, and it's this. Our current slump has been going on a lot longer than you might think. Many people believe the recession began when Lehman Brothers collapsed. That happened in September 2008, just 6 weeks before the historic presidential election. But the economy had already been declining through 2008, and the United States was already in recession when the financial collapse began. The National Bureau of Economic Research, which is the semi-official arbiter of these things, reckons that the recession began 3.5 years ago. That's December 2007. But if you sift through the old data, you see that the downturn may have begun even earlier. When the economy is this weak for this long, it's time for policymakers to abandon the fiction that a sick economy will heal itself. Let me explain. Economists usually evaluate economic conditions by evaluating gross domestic product, which we affectionately call GDP. Most economic commentary focuses on the headline number, which is the sum of all spending in the economy. But there's an alternative way of measuring GDP. You just add up all of our incomes. In theory, the two measures should be the same. After all, every dollar you spend is a dollar of income to someone else. But in practice, measurements differ. Most economists are focused on the less informative measure. But the better data measuring total income show that the economy entered a recession in late 2006. Today, our gross domestic product is only around the level it was at when the recession began. So if it feels like we've been in a downturn for a long time, you're right. It's been nearly 5 years. In the wake of the financial crisis, many economists argued we need to do whatever we can to avoid a lost decade. Unfortunately, here's my progress report. We're halfway there.
Justin Wolfers is an associate professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business. You got a comment? Write to us at marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. Today, Consumer Reports released new hospital ratings. Several teaching hospitals appeared at the bottom of the list, which was based on infection rates. Perhaps what those doctors in training need is a little more practice in treating patients, that is, fake patients, for real problems. From Philadelphia, Mara Zepeda looks at how the medical simulation industry could save the healthcare industry billions.
In the 1980s, Dr. David Gaba noticed simulation training was standard for some professions. Pilots learned how to fly in fake cockpits. Soldiers practiced how to fight on replicated battlefields. So why not doctors?
Well, I've sometimes been called the father or the grandfather or the godfather of mannequin-based simulation.
Gaba is associate dean for simulation at Stanford's medical school. 30 years ago, the technology didn't exist, so Gaba took matters into his own hands. He was like the MacGyver of mannequins, using screwdrivers, balloons, and tape. He even wrote his own computer code. Doctors could practice monitoring oxygen levels, inserting breathing tubes, or dealing with a collapsed lung on these makeshift mannequins.
In the very early years, most people said, oh, well, that's an interesting toy. I hope you have some fun with that or something.
But that toy eventually became a product. In 2000, a company called Laridol introduced the Simman. They had many of the features that GABA was trying to create. A pulse, blood pressure, and dilating eyes. Back then, a Simman cost about $250,000. Now, Simman are $70,000. As this technology became more affordable, more simulation labs cropped up. Labs like this simulated emergency room at Drexel University's College of Nursing. It's 9 a.m. on a Monday when suddenly...
Excuse me. We just had a bus explode down by the Liberty Bell. It's an official disaster in the city of Philadelphia. First of all, does anybody have any experience with mass casualties?
It's a chaotic scene as more than a dozen victims of the blast are wheeled in on gurneys. Some are mannequins, like the ones you see in shop windows. Some are sim men. And then there are pretend patients, played by real people, like Chris Eden.
Can you tell me your name?
My name is Chris.
Are you having any pain?
My head hurts so much.
Drills like these might translate into fewer malpractice suits and shorter hospital stays. That could save the healthcare system as much as $79 billion each year. That potential for huge savings has accelerated the industry's growth. For makers of fake blood and sim men, business has never been better. Rocky Rockstraw, the assistant dean of simulation at Drexel, is a regular customer.
You know, it's expensive when people start talking about outfitting their schools and their colleges with simulation.
And taxpayers will be footing some of this bill. So how do we know if simulation even works? Robert Furberg analyzes healthcare technology at Research Triangle Institute.
It's really important to acknowledge that clinical simulation is still very young. There just isn't enough of an evidence base.
Furberg says it's a chicken and egg problem. He says we won't know if simulation works unless the government forks over the money to fund and study it and build that evidence base.
I think ultimately there's an indirect benefit to taxpayers. I mean, if reduction of medical error is associated with a reduction in overall healthcare cost,
the Department of Health and Human Services will soon announce $10.5 million in new medical simulation grants over the next 3 years, which will mean more funding for things like this.
What I'm going to do now is I'm going to use much more liquid blood and let it run down the side of his face and drip onto his clothes, which is actually natural, so we're okay with that.
In Philadelphia, I'm Mata Zapeta for Marketplace.
Coming up, imagine hearing this on your first day at work.
If you make an emergency phone call without asking, you may be let go.
Yikes. But first, let's do the numbers. Hearing from the Fed chairman did nothing to boost investor confidence today. The Dow fell 19 points. That's 0.1% to close at 12,070. The NASDAQ took off 1 point. Call it flat to finish at 2701. The S&P 500 also dropped 1 point. That's 0.1% to wrap up at 1284. Cablevision beamed up 4.5%. It's going to spin off some of its networks, AMC, the Sundance Channel, and WeTV as a separate company with its own stock. Intel clicked up 1% after an analyst said the chipmaker is forming a foundry relationship with Apple. That basically means Intel may make a deal to provide chips to future iPads and iPhones. Bond prices rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note at 2.99%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve releases its latest Beige Book summary of current economic conditions. President Obama holds a video conference with President Karzai of Afghanistan. And it's a day to celebrate your connection to that giant body of water off the coast. June 8th is World Oceans Day. Dive in. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. Today is the first day of China's national entrance examination, known in Chinese as the Gaokao. Millions of Chinese high school graduates will spend 3 nerve-wracking days taking a test that will pretty much decide the rest of their lives. But is China's test-obsessed culture producing the innovators it needs to compete in the 21st century economy? Marketplace's Rob Schmitz has the first in a series of stories on China's education crisis.
18-year-old Wan Chao is memorizing a lot of things these days, but as he sits in his bedroom overlooking the busy Shanghai Expressway on this cool evening in March, the number 87 is on his mind.
In exactly 87 days, I take the Gaokao. Ever since the beginning of senior year, I felt anxious and scared, all because of this test.
Wan's score on this test will help determine the university he attends, what he studies, his career, where he'll meet a potential spouse, and how much money he'll make. And that's why Wan spends nearly every waking hour studying.
Careful. Careless. Cargo.
He studies English by repeating words from a dictionary, sometimes spelling them out loud. The same memorization exercise is performed daily at high schools throughout China.
Funerals.
Funerals.
At a high school in Shanghai, English teacher Gao Shui-Ming is preparing her students for an upcoming quiz. Teacher Gao admits the exercise is about as much fun as a funeral, but it's the most efficient way to prepare for the Gaokao.
Because, you know, we should have students should take the entrance examination, and so correctness is very important.
Taking exams has been the way to get ahead in China since the 7th century A.D., Back then, mastering the Confucian classics was the ticket to a job in the imperial bureaucracy. Today, 15-year-olds here in Shanghai overwhelmingly beat out their peers throughout the world last year in the Program for International Student Assessment, an international standardized test. American 15-year-olds ranked 17th.
This test proved that our students from Shanghai are the world's best students in reading, science, and math.
Wang Jianding is the principal of Xinzhuang High School in Shanghai.
I think there are several factors contributing to our students' success. First, Chinese society traditionally values education. Secondly, the Chinese government has ensured a solid education system as the foundation of rapid economic development.
But is acing a standardized test the key to an innovative economy?
The education system and its inability to train analytical students is the biggest crisis facing China today.
Sean Ryan is the managing director of China Market Research, a market intelligence firm based in Shanghai. He says after studying for tests for most of their lives, Chinese graduates are programmed to memorize correct answers instead of performing the more complex task of working out a solution themselves. Ryan's firm recruits analysts from China's top universities. He's found they're very good at researching data,
but they can't take it to the next level. And when they try to develop a strategy or synthesize the information, they tend to just copy something that they saw being done elsewhere in the market. So they say, oh, that company did this, let's do the exact same thing, rather than saying, this is what the trends are, this is what the competition has done, this is where we think you need to be in order to really grow well in China.
Ryan says another problem is these 20-somethings, little emperors from the one-child generation, are still at home and spoiled.
Their parents went through the horrors of the Cultural Revolution and don't want their kids to have any difficult times. So they're enablers. They tell their kids, oh, don't work late. If you run into a tough situation, go work at a state-owned enterprise. It'll be easier there.
Ryan's firm recently interviewed Fortune 500 companies in China. It found that most of them have an annual turnover rate of around 30%. In the U.S., 11% is considered high. Ryan says most Chinese graduates are not qualified for a global business system. He predicts this will soon start to wear on China's economy. He says multinationals, frustrated with Chinese employees, may start to hire more foreigners or they'll relocate operations somewhere else.
Cut. C-R-T.
But none of this matters to student Wan Chao trying to memorize an English dictionary in a Shanghai bedroom. In the next room, his mom and dad bicker about their son's study habits.
The problem is he doesn't want to understand his mistakes.
He doesn't ask questions. I said it's okay if you make mistakes, but you need to figure out why you make mistakes. I've told him, if you fail the Gaokao, I won't do anything for you. You have to feed yourself and wash your own socks.
Stop talking. What's the point of talking about it over and over?
Juan's mother says her son doesn't understand how serious the situation is. If he fails the Gaokao, he'll fail to find a good job. And as any Chinese parent knows, without a good job, there's little hope for
prosperity.
In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
And you can find out more about the Gaokao and China's education system on Rob's Chinopoly blog at marketplace.org. 15 years ago, Daniel Orozco published the short story Orientation. It's a guided tour of a new office filled with salacious tidbits about the co-workers, delivered in an absurdly deadpan voice.
Those are the offices and these are the cubicles. That's my cubicle there. And this is your cubicle. This is your phone. Never answer your phone. Let the voicemail system answer it. This is your voicemail system manual. There are no personal phone calls allowed. We do, however, allow for emergencies. If you must make an emergency phone call, ask your supervisor first. If you can't find your supervisor, ask Philip Spears, who sits over there. He'll check with Clarissa Nix, who sits over there. If you make an emergency phone call without asking, you may be let go.
Orozco had been working various office jobs when he wrote the story. Human resources, a temp during the summers. Now he teaches creative writing at the University of Idaho, and Orientation is the title story in his just-released debut collection of short stories. Daniel Orozco, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
The question might be obvious, but why do you write about work?
I have this weird notion that you find out more about somebody at work than you do anywhere else. And I think it has to do with the fact that at work you are somehow constrained, and you adapt to that. The office is filled with many, many petty and mean and arduous tests. I think when you are tested, that's when you reveal who you are.
You mentioned that you worked in HR for a period and also that you were a temp. And so that must be where the bit called Temporary Stories comes from, also in this collection. In it, a woman is trained on answering calls from job seekers. Can you read a bit from the top paragraph of page 128?
Yeah, let me read this. So, began a woman on line 6, do you think I should apply for this position to get my foot in the door and take the chance of getting stuck in a dead-end job? Or should I risk waiting for the job I really want to come up, which could possibly be never? Tell me, line 3 implored. Tell me I haven't missed the application deadline for the job in medical records. Please, 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 please tell me that. Guess where I'm sleeping, line 4 began. Okay, I'll tell you, I'm sleeping on my brother-in-law's living room sofa. I'm a 44-year-old man sleeping on my brother-in-law's living room sofa, and if I don't get a job by the end of the month, the punk is going to toss me out on my ass.
Your description of the office here is so detailed. How much of your experience comes into this?
This phone call stuff is absolutely true. It is practically transcribed. I hated doing phone work. I found out too much about people, and that made me uncomfortable. I just wanted to answer the phone, and what I was getting were these glimpses of these lives looking for work.
There's such a humanity in your depiction of these characters, despite the fact that they're in a place that I think a lot of people think is a dehumanizing place.
Yeah. There is a lot of comedy, even while things are very sad, but I never want to be making fun of these people. My mom and dad worked in factories for years. My mom packed licorice for over 20 years, and I marvel at that. I mean, she could take a long bus ride home and be kind of, you know, human and nice, and I've never forgotten that. There is dignity in any work, no matter how dehumanizing it may be.
Daniel Orozco, his debut collection of fiction is called Orientation. You can read the title story on our Big Book blog at marketplace.org/thebigbook. Daniel Orozco, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, even without its champion performer, NBC won gold today in the competition over TV rights to the Olympics. Last month, longtime NBC sports chief Dick Ebersol left the network, which was recently taken over by Comcast. Today, the International Olympic Committee awarded the TV deal to NBC through the 2020 Games, with or without Ebersol. All it took was a bid of $4.4 billion. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 19 points. That's 0.1%. The NASDAQ took off 1 point. It was flat. And the S&P also dropped 1 point, 0.1%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. And that is where you can turn for the latest in business and economic news tomorrow. Next time on this show, students in China work hard to get into college. But once they arrive, things do change.
In fact, maybe they're taking some very creative people and making them uncreative. And so this has tremendous economic implications.
Part two in our series about education in China. I'm Tess Vegland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.